of it, there is nothing to confront, just hypocrisy and inconsistency while we pretend that we are alone with the standards bare and the profit shared. We should count our days numbered. Of it, there is nothing to conceal, just conspiracy and atrocity while we contend with the end. All alone with the hardly end and the bridges burn, we should count our days numbered. That's a tragedy of the strategy of looking out for number one.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is the thoughts and ideas of David Stockman. David Stockman was one of the architects of the Reagan Revolution and claims that crony capitalism has transformed Republican Treasury secretaries into big government interventionists and populist Democratic presidents into industry-wrecking internationalists. He questions the assumptions of Keynesianism and monetarists alike, arguing that both liberal and neoconservative interference in markets can be damaging and often dangerous. Stockman was elected as a Michigan congressman in 1976 and joined the Reagan White House in 1981.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kathy Bennett Warner, Communications Director of the Corrett Foundation, and your chair for this evening's program. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. Tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's American Values series, underwritten by the Corrett and Toby Family Foundations. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, David Stockman, former budget director under President Ronald Reagan and author of the new book, The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. David Stockman was elected as a Michigan congressman in 1976 and joined the Reagan White House in 1981. Serving as budget director, he was one of the key architects of the Reagan Revolution plan to reduce taxes, cut spending, and shrink the role of government. He joined Solomon Brothers in 1985 and later became one of the early partners of the Blackstone Group. During nearly two decades at Blackstone and at a firm he founded, Heartland Industrial Partners, Mr. Stockman was a private equity investor. Born in Fort Hood, Texas, Mr. Stockman attended Michigan State University and Harvard Divinity School and then went to Washington as a congressional aide in 1970. In his new book, The Great Deformation, Mr. Stockman describes how the working of free markets and democracy has long been under threat in America and provides a surprising catalog of the corruptors and defenders. His analysis overturns the assumptions of Keynesians and monetarists alike, demonstrating his view that both liberal and neoconservative interference in markets has proved damaging and often dangerous. Mr. Stockman says that over time, crony capitalism has made fools of us all, transforming Republican Treasury secretaries into big government interventionists and populist Democrat presidents into industry-wrecking internationalists. Please join me in welcoming David Stockman.
Well, thank you for going through my whole resume so that now everyone is clear that I've never held a steady job during my entire life. Nevertheless, I really am gratified, I have to say this, and pleased that so many people came out tonight to hear about my book. Because the word has been out now for over a week that I'm not a real author. I basically do rants and screeds and become unhinged from time to time. And according to Professor Paul Krugman, actually the whole thing is just the rant of a cranky old man. So, you know, actually I was a cranky young man my whole life and I never got over it. But in any event, when he said that, after the summary of the book appeared in the New York Times about a week ago, the book went straight up the list, and the only thing that stopped it was three diet books and something called The Walking Dead. So then I realized I was in the right zip code, because to be real honest about this, this is about the diet we're going to go on as a nation, I think, for quite a while, because we have had such bad policy, this massive buildup of debt, public and private, for 30 years now. The Fed has been turned into a bubble machine, and I'll talk about that. We have prosperity on Wall Street. We have, real desperation on Main Street, and it's not getting any better. But I did notice when I go to various events, and even tonight, someone was looking apprehensively at the girth of this book. And I will admit, that it weighs 2 pounds. However, the good news tonight is I think it can be, the 700 pages can be boiled down to 7 words. Do not believe Washington or Wall Street. And by that, I essentially mean that we have a vast disconnect between the reality that's going on in the real economy, let's call it the Main Street of America, from coast to coast, and the dialogue that goes on inside the Beltway and on the other end of I-95 in Wall Street. And what I think has happened over the last several decades, and the book is really all about this and develops it sort of decade by decade, decision by decision, critical event by event, that we have had the rise of something that I call crony capitalism, which unfortunately is the worst of both worlds. It really undermines the notion of a free market economy that can generate tremendous growth and investment and productivity and rising living standards and more wealth, and a political democracy, which we have always believed and cherished in this country and believed for a long time that we had still functioning. But I think I can show you, or at least we develop in the book, and I'll give a few summary lines on that tonight, is that that has been really deformed, and that's where I get the title of the book, as a result of things that we've been doing for several decades now that violate my three principles. One, fiscal rectitude. I think you can't borrow forever like we're doing now and lay it off all onto the next generation and leave them with the bills and leave them with huge tax payments to cover the interest on all this debt that we're creating. I don't think you can have a Federal Reserve that prints as much money as it's doing now, showers it onto Wall Street. Most of it stays in the canyons of Wall Street. It helps the speculators. It helps the gamblers. But it really doesn't get into productive investment in our private economy. So what I want to say tonight is that we have a fundamental breakdown or failure in all three of the important components of our system. The political parties, in my judgment, have really failed. And if you look at what's happening now, and political parties used to be important in democracy, but if you look at what's happening now in Washington, I would say the political parties have become glorified concierges. And basically, their job is to introduce politicians to money and to PACs and to K Streets to help them get reelected. Both parties do it. Both parties profess various kinds of platforms and ideological goals and so forth, but really when push comes to shove, they don't stand for anything. Now, I've come from the conservative side, the Republican side, but I am really mortified to say the Republicans don't stand anymore when they make decisions, not when they give speeches. I mean, we have our Lincoln Day dinners and so forth, and you can hear all the grand rhetoric you want about how we can't live beyond our means, the government's too big, we've got to shrink the beast and all of this. But what they've done when they've been in power in the last 2 decades has been nearly the opposite. After all, who bailed out Wall Street? Who bailed out AIG? Who started the bailout of the auto industry and GM? It was a Republican White House. It violated all the rules of the free market. It violated the principle that if you make errors, if you make mistakes, if you have failure, then the consequences have to unfold, or you can't have a private economy that's productive and healthy. You will get moral hazard. You will get everyone thinking you can swing for the fences, you can leverage yourself, you can take big risks, and if somehow things don't work out and you run into failure, they're going to come and put a safety net under you, and particularly this happened in Wall Street. So here's the Republican Party doing that. Here's the Republican Party running huge deficits in peacetime during the Bush era, and I'm not particularly trying to pick on him. I could find other areas, other administrations to talk about, but running huge peacetime deficits, unfinanced wars, two of them that we never should have had, two huge tax cuts that, you know, tax cuts are fine if you cut spending by the same amount and are willing to pay your bills. None of that happened.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Got a letter from LBJ. It said, this is your lucky day. It's time to put your khaki trousers on. Though it may seem very queer, we've got no job to give you here, so we are sending you to Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese. I jumped off the old troop ship and sank in mud up to my hips. I cussed until the captain called me down. Never mind how hard it's raining, think of all the ground we're gaining. Just don't take one step outside of town. Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese. Every night the local gentry slip out past the sleeping sentry. They go out to join the old VC. In their nightly little dramas, they put on their black pajamas and come lobbing mortar shells at me. But Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese. Go around in helicopters like a bunch of big grasshoppers searching for the Viet Cong in vain. They left the note that they had gone, they had to get down to Saigon, their government positions to maintain. And Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation, I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese. Well, here I sit in this rice paddy, wondering about Big Daddy, and I know that Lyndon loves me so. Yet how sadly I remember way back yonder in November when he said I'd never have to go. But Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation, I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese.
Now, you're going to say, why are you being so hard on the Republicans? I don't have to be hard on the Democrats. They're hard on themselves in terms of, you know, some of the things that they tell you. And I have many, many things to say about that in the book. And if you look at my heroes and villains, I don't say this in a personal sense, but in a policy sense, who made the big right decisions over time, you know, since the 1950s or even going back sooner? Who made the wrong decisions? You can look at my list. I sort of have 18 on on either side, and it's pretty much a mix of Republicans and Democrats. For instance, my heroes start with Calvin Coolidge, and of course this drives the Keynesians nuts and all the people who think that we're actually on the right track with this constant, you know, stimulus to the economy and deficit spending and a Fed that's really out of control. But I also go through the middle period of the decade or the century and talk about Eisenhower and what a fantastic president he really was. Retrospectively, because he actually balanced the budget 4 times out of 8. Nobody's come close. If you take his entire 8 years, the average deficit was 0.5% of GDP. Well, today, if they get 0.5% of GDP deficit, they would say, hallelujah, you know, salvation has come. They can't even get close to that where we are today. But more than that, Eisenhower was a war hero who said the Defense Department is a danger if we let it get out of control, if we let the budget get too big, if we allow the military-industrial complex to have too much influence in the legislative process and in the policy equation. And unbelievably, Eisenhower cut the defense budget in today's dollars. And I like to put everything in today's dollars because then the numbers might make sense to you. He cut it from $530 billion when he entered office that was left by Truman after the Korean War to $370 billion. That is by 30%, by basically saying we're going to cut back the war machine of the United States to only what we need to deal with the real Soviet threat, the real Soviet nuclear threat, but we're not going to have a big land force. We're not going to have the capability to, engage in wars of invasion and occupation because that's not where our national interest lies. And so the reason I mention this is that he was the last president who actually tamed the Pentagon. He was the last president who actually stood up to the military-industrial complex, cut the defense budget in today's dollars to under $400 billion. Now they're down there today having a big fight about whether the defense budget should be $650 billion or $620 billion, same dollars, same purchasing power, nearly 80% more than Eisenhower thought was necessary to deal with a real enemy, the Soviet Union, that still had an economy that functioned. Here we are today. Some people in the Beltway haven't got the memo. The Cold War ended in 1990. The Soviet Union is no more. Russia has become a kleptocracy, which is far more interested in stealing from each other than they are impinging on their neighbors. The only other industrial economy that could even mount a threat to us is the red capitalist miracle of China. And obviously, they're the biggest export machine in the world. They're the Nike and Apple capital of the world. They desperately need markets for all this stuff they're making. Are they going to bomb 3,000 Walmarts in America? I think not. So the point that I'm making here is that this is a bipartisan issue. I started out, and the book is about a lot more than defense and the welfare state and what a great hero Eisenhower was. But the reason I'm talking about it is that way back in 1967 when I was in college, and I can see there's probably a couple people out here who were also in college in 1967, I cut my eye teeth politically protesting the war in Vietnam, marching on the Pentagon, and wondering what in the world are we doing in Southeast Asia in the jungles, not dropping napalm from the sky against people who couldn't possibly harm the United States. Well, they had all these theories then of the domino and all the domino theory and all of that, but we know today that that was nonsense. We know that in 1961, 2, and 3, when this thing was escalated, the people in China were starving in their villages because Mao's wonderful theory of collectivizing agriculture and turning everybody into a backyard steelmaker was destroying his economy. They lost 40 million people to starvation in China at the time we were invading Vietnam to stop the Chinese from coming across the border. They couldn't get across the border. They were starving, okay? So when we look at the history of this, one of the great problems we still have in 2013 is we're a much older society now. The baby boom is heading towards retirement. We now have a $17 trillion national debt. It was $1 trillion when I started with Reagan. And we still have a war machine in place that makes no sense. Now, the reason I mentioned about being an anti-war protester is that in my original political foray in life, I worked for the peace candidate in 1968. And the peace candidate was Bobby Kennedy, and he didn't make it through the campaign. Then there was Gene McCarthy, and he got shunted aside. And the point I'm making is that now, finally, in 2008, 40 years later, the peace candidate finally won. Obama won the election. He had a huge mandate. Enough of these wars. What they were telling you about Iraq, we're going to win the hearts and minds of the people, is the same thing I heard when I was a kid in 1965, that all we were going to do is win the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people by destroying their villages and other things. And we knew that that didn't make any sense then, and here we're doing it again. Same thing in Afghanistan. But anyway, the peace candidate finally wins in 1968, and the peace candidate, what does he do? He ends up increasing the defense budget even beyond this huge level that it was left at by George Bush and setting it at 80 billion, 80% higher than what Eisenhower, the real general that we ever had in the White House, said was necessary. What I say in my book is that this is the power of the military-industrial complex, that Obama had a mandate and he beat his plowshares into a mightier sword. Now, I think the Old Testament said you're supposed to beat your sword into a plowshare, but he got it backwards. Now, why do I pick so hard, you know, trying to introduce my book on the military-industrial complex and this whole issue of the defense budget, which is only part of it? The reason I do is that it's an illustration of the power of crony capitalism. We are running this massive military budget today because it's a jobs program, because the defense contractors have to have another fighter, brand new fighter, modern fighter, when we have nobody to use it on anywhere in the world. That they have to continue to have a 11-carrier battle group navy when no one else in the world even has a navy with two carrier battle groups. In fact, if some of you may be interested to know that China, you know, even though they couldn't possibly attack us because they would destroy their economy if they did, but China has one aircraft carrier battle group, aircraft carrier. Now, where did they get that aircraft carrier? Well, they bought it used from the Ukraine, all right? And where did the Ukraine get it? Well, they stole it from the Soviet Union when the whole evil empire supposedly collapsed. So this is why we're maintaining, at a cost of billions and tens of billions a year, 11 aircraft carrier battle groups. That's just not the carrier. It's got all the planes and all the escort ships and all the electronics and so forth. It is really kind of a madness. And I think it's easy sometimes for people to see that if they're this far off base on the defense issues, on national security, if they're this subservient to the military-industrial complex, then what do we say about the tax code? I say it's the same thing. For the last 20 years or so, the tax code has been written by the K Street lobbyists. And the reason it's a, you know, loophole-riddled embarrassment, disgrace, is that it is controlled lock, stock, and barrel by one PAC and one interest group after another. And unfortunately, my Republican colleagues, and I'm a lapsed Republican now, as some of you might tell by what I'm saying, but my Republican colleagues got hooked on the idea that fiscal rectitude is no longer important. Remember, Cheney said deficits don't matter, and those are some of the worst words ever spoken, you know, in the Beltway by a Republican, I think.
Coming up next, Malcolm X. He was an African-American Muslim minister and human rights activist. To his admirers, he was a courageous advocate for the rights of blacks, a man who indicted white America in the harshest terms for its crimes against black Americans. Detractors accuse him of preaching racism, black supremacy, and violence.
A white man, he wants you to remain a boy. He wants you to remain a lackey. He wants you to remain dependent on him. He wants you to come looking to him for some kind of advice or some kind of teacher. No, you teach yourself and stand up for yourself and respect yourself and know yourself and defend yourself and be yourself, and you'll be recognized as an intelligent person. I purposely say the government. That's who it is. FBI, CIA. They sneak around here in Harlem trying to frighten you into thinking that if you be a Muslim, you're going to catch hell. You already caught hell. You can't catch any more hell than you have caught. No, anytime you live in a government where it's Federal Bureau of Investigation will spend its time running around here trying to frighten Negroes into thinking that they will be chastised for becoming Muslim, for accepting the religion of Islam. That government has fallen to a low level. Anytime, and the FBI does it. The FBI walks around here asking questions, trying to frighten somebody. They ought to be told this is a new day. Nobody afraid of any FBI. Why should they bother us? We obey the law. We respect the law. We teach our people to obey the law. They should thank us. They should try and get you to become a Muslim. But they don't want you to be a law-abiding person. They don't want you to be a respecter of the law. They want you to be a criminal. They want you to be a lawbreaker. They want you to be immoral so they'll have an alibi to come in and bust your head with their club. No, this is what the FBI does. And God's going to chastise them for using their power in the wrong way. No, that's what they do with their officers down there in the Department of Injustice, calling themselves, or rather in the Department of Justice, calling themselves their respecter or protector of someone's rights. This is not fair for them to do this. They know what I'm saying is true. It's what they do. They come knocking on our door trying to frighten our little children. Are you a Muslim? What you look like asking our little children, is that child a Muslim? I tell the old devil, you must believe it too, or you wouldn't be wasting all your money trying to track us down. One of those old blue-eyed things had the nerve a couple of years ago to go to Philadelphia and tell the Muslims. They said, Brother Malcolm is talking about white people and he's in New York living with a white woman. Imagine this. I told the brothers, next time the old FBI come and tell you that, you tell them that if I'm in New York living with a white woman, it's his mother.
And now for something completely different.